Oh, hey, I'm Coco, and welcome to our talk show, Single and Too Tired to Mingle. We'll be talking about relationships with ourselves, our exes, our kids, and other important beings. So stay tuned. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Coco. Hi.
So happy you could make it to today's Tuesday talk.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to come here.
Yeah. So Professor Deborah Christie, you are a clinical psychologist and a professor of pediatric and adolescent psychology at UCL. You are an internationally recognized expert for the care of young people with chronic illnesses. And you're also a co-editor-in-chief of Clinical Child Psychology and Psychiatry. So those are some big words, adolescence and psychology. And these are the things that we'll be talking about today. So I'm very excited to talk about that. To start off, maybe tell us about your interest in the subject and how you became a specialist in adolescence.
Okay, well, it's a long story, but I'll do the short version for you, Coco. So I always wanted to be a psychologist. I was always interested in behavior, but particularly in children, why children behaved in particular ways. And I was interested in children with learning disabilities. So right from 13, I wanted to be a psychologist. And I kind of continued that path. So I did my psychology and I did my PhD in neuroscience, which was really about the brain. So understanding how the brain worked. And then I started working with children who had cancer and understanding what impact the treatment of cancer had had on them and their functioning. And then I went to UCLH and it was to set up a unit for adolescents. Now, adolescent health as a specialism is very big in America, very big in Australia, but 25 years ago, there was nowhere in the UK that was focusing on adolescents. And the difference, the main difference was that rather than thinking of a child as an illness, we thought of adolescence as the primary diagnosis. Okay. Kids had a space to come because they were an adolescent. Okay. They were in that age group. And they also happened to have an illness or a condition. And I just loved it. I was fascinated by it, incredibly challenging at times, but it was also really exciting. And that was it, really. I was hooked. And so that's what I've spent the last 25 years doing, 26 years doing. It's horrible when you add it all up. Yeah, we'll move on from that.
Yeah, adolescence is such an interesting topic, I have to say. Mm. So we all know, we kind of all understand children, little children, but then eventually these little children have a tendency to grow.
They do.
And what is the main difference in your opinion and expertise between a child and an adolescent?
Well, one's fun and the other's annoying, but a slightly more scientific answer, perhaps. I mean, the main changes are biological. So there's a change in the body shape, the body function, and the appearance. So children start to change their faces and their bodies and they start to look like grown-ups, functioning adults. So that's the biological changes. Then there's psychological changes. And the main psychological change is a search for identity. So adolescents are trying to work out who they are and who they want to be and who they want to be with. And so there's that personal identity, sexual identity, gender identity, all of those identities start to coalesce in adolescence. And also the way that an adolescent thinks is different from a child. So children are very concrete, you know, they want something and they want it now. Whereas an adolescent can start to think about a bigger picture, the future, and that all fits in with them kind of working out their identity and who they want to be. And the third set of changes that makes an adolescent very different from a child is social changes. So the biggest one that everybody is familiar with is that adolescents don't want to be with their mums and dads and family. It's true. Yeah, kind of.
Which I'm discovering now.
Yeah, they, you know, disappear into their bedrooms, yeah, or they want to go out. There's a move towards their peer groups being so much more important. They don't really care what you think, but they do care what their friends think. And they also start to make connections with the, I guess, the political. The personal becomes political for the adolescents. They feel stuff, you know, things matter to them, saving the world. I mean, look at all the climate change marches with all those teenagers that were on those marches, and people like Greta Thunberg is a great example. So that sort of biopsychosocial development is what's happening during adolescence. And it's a process. It starts around 10 or 11, mm-hmm, around puberty, and then it keeps going. And some people like to think, oh, 16 and we're done. Sadly not. Unfortunately, your adolescent child will become an adolescent and then an emerging adult. So it's not really all done.
It keeps going.
Yeah, it keeps going until sort of early 20s. So you need a lot of patience and perseverance.
I just remember an anecdote. I was saying to one of my friends, oh, I feel so guilty because I haven't seen my second son in quite a while, because they're both teenagers. Mm. And she's like, oh, yeah, because every teenage son wants to hang out with his mother.
No, I know.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, let me just leave him. He'll come to me when he needs me.
And the funniest bit about it is that you know what it is to be an adolescent because you were one.
Yeah, exactly.
But I always think it's a bit like childbirth. You know, you kind of like you do it and it's painful, but then you forget about you know. And unlike childbirth, you don't ever have to do adolescence again. Once you've done it, you've done it.
That's it.
But we all know it, but we kind of lose touch with it and we forget about it. And then we get irritated by it. And that's why I do a lot of teaching around adolescence, is to try and reconnect people with their adolescent experience.
Yeah, exactly.
And help them kind of understand that if they can reconnect with that, then they can communicate better with an adolescent boy or girl.
It's actually interesting. So the brain finishes developing quite late, mid to late 20s.
Yeah.
Which is actually quite shocking. Like, you would not believe that. And especially the prefrontal cortex, so just behind our forehead. Mm. Why is this important? Why should maybe children or adolescents know this? And especially, why should parents know this?
Well, I don't think adolescents care.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I think they could care less what their brain is doing. But I think it's important for us because it gives us an explanatory framework. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of wave of cortical activity from the back of the brain all the way down to the front to this prefrontal cortex. And with all of the imaging that we can do and have, we know that whereas we used to think the brain was all done and dusted by 15, 16, it keeps going until the late 20s. So this part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex here and here, and its connections down into things like the limbic system, the emotional regulation part of the brain, that bit doesn't finish. Now, why is it important? Well, it's because the limbic part of the brain and the dopamine searching parts of the brain underpin sensation seeking, which of course we think of as risk taking, but it's more like exploratory behavior. So adolescents' brains are driving them to look for new experiences, look for new learning opportunities. But because their prefrontal cortex hasn't fully established, that's the kind of I won't swear because you'll have to bleep me out.
Okay.
But it's
it's my podcast. We can do what we want.
it's the bit, the frontal cortex is the bit of the, it's the bit that says, don't do that. Mm-hmm. Don't say that. Take a beat before you do such and such a thing. Yeah. And so that drives this kind of bulletproofness that adolescents have, mm-hmm, because their decision-making, A, it's quite impulsive, because you need your prefrontal cortex to inhibit responses. But it also is not controlling the emotional response. So you think to yourself, well, hell, it won't happen to me, or I want to, you know, and your dopamine searching systems are going, oh, more dopamine, more dopamine, more dopamine. And your prefrontal cortex hasn't really got into place to go, not a good idea, guys. And so, of course, if there's an adult, we kind of remember that that's what's going on in an adolescent brain. It can help us take a beat. It can help us go, okay, so they're not being difficult. It's just they're the we're the victim of our biology in some ways. Our brain, the adolescent brain, is wired to behave like an adolescent. It's driving all
until
of those.
Until late 20s, nonetheless.
Until the late 20s. Well, that's why... that's why the insurance, that's why you think, oh, I buy them... They pass their license at 17 and you want to buy them a car and your insurance is through the roof.
Yeah.
Because they are impulsive and they make mistakes when they're driving, especially when they've got their friends in the car. So they're more impulsive.
So moving back to parents a little bit, I found with my two sons that... Okay, fine, they're children. And then all of a sudden I thought, actually, I have to deal with them differently now that they're teenagers, which I found quite interesting as a mindset.
Mm.
So would you have any advice for parents how to kind of manage, you know, not treating your child or your teen or adolescent as a child, but actually you have to adapt to the stage that they're in?
Yeah, I mean, there's that process by which they kind of like, they don't think you really understand what it's like to be an adolescent. As we've already mentioned, we were one, but we don't remember it. Yeah. And so when we say to them, I'd like you home by 11 o'clock, it's, I think you're being mean, rather than actually, I love you, I care for you, and I want you to be safe. Mm. So the boundaries that we want to put in place are pushed against. Having said that, it's important to have those boundaries in place. But it's about negotiating.
Isn't it better to kind of set boundaries with them?
Sometimes? Well, yes, and decide what battles you want to win. Yeah. You know, you've got to pick your battles. Yeah. But at the same time, I think certainly my sons have said to me, you're a good mum. Well, they didn't say that at the time, but they now, as they're adults, thank you both, thank you very much. Now that they're adults and they've got their own kids, they're now in a situation where they're seeing that you do need to have some boundaries, you do need to have some guidelines. So it is challenging. And I think the hardest bit is the bit that you've mentioned, the fact that they don't want to be with you anymore, that they want to be either on the phone to their mates, or they want to be on their tablets, or they want to be
Think, have I failed?
Yeah. And actually you've succeeded. Yeah, I think that's the thing. You've succeeded. Because if they do occasionally come down to be fed and watered, well, then that's a success, because they still want to be with you, but it's with you on their terms. Yeah. And it's then important to remember it's only a temporary period of time. It's the shortest period of time in their life. It's not very long, because once they get into their 20s, if you've done okay, they will want to hang out with you.
They will come back
and they will watch the telly with you, and they will we climbed Snowdon a few weeks ago, and both of the boys were with us with their kids, and it was really, really nice walking and talking with them now as adults. So yeah, it's hard. And there's no easy answer. I think patience and negotiated lines of battle is the best way to manage it.
As long as we're aware it's hard, I think.
Yeah, and forgiving ourselves.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I mean, not trying to be perfect. Mm. I mean, there is no such thing as a perfect parent of an adolescent. If there is, you're weird. You know, you just can't. You've got to get it wrong sometimes. Yeah. And you've got to demonstrate to them that you're comfortable getting it wrong. Mm.
Admitting it sometimes. If you're wrong, you're wrong, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And role, you know, sort of really sort of modelling the behaviour that you would like them to see. Because that's another one that is quite funny, is that, you know, parents will complain about kids on their phones, and yet the parents are on their phones all the time. Or they'll complain about them drinking. And what do the parents do at the weekend? they drink. What's the difference? You've got to model, yeah. model some of the behaviors that you'd like. So if you don't want them on their phones all the time, and you definitely don't want them on the phones at dinner time, well, then you shouldn't be on your phone at dinner time. So you need to negotiate those battle lines. What's acceptable, what's reasonable, and what's your line in the sand?
Yeah, I like that. Very sensible, I think. So we have adolescence, and then you have been extensively working with adolescents with actually chronic illnesses.
Yeah.
So again, two big topics rolled into one. So tell us more about that. And what are these chronic illnesses that adolescents can have?
So illness or medical condition, I think it's important to say that, because some conditions aren't an illness as such. So things like diabetes is a very good example, type 1 diabetes in adolescents particularly, with a peak diagnosis in early teens. Right. Things like arthritis, but you can also have, obviously, there's things like cancer. Any condition it could be chronic fatigue or chronic pain. And in fact, adolescents, their bodies become much more sensitive to pain and also fatigue because of hormonal changes. Right. So again, chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic pain syndrome. So any condition which is either never going to go away, like diabetes, or is going to be around for a long time would be classed as a chronic condition. So something like diabetes or arthritis requires medication.
Right.
And for an adolescent, taking a medication is a challenge. It interferes with their life.
Is it also a stigma?
It can be. So young people with diabetes, when they're injecting, for example, people can say unkind things, they can make nasty comments. And of course, stigma comes from ignorance and fear and prejudice and unconscious bias. So anything where you are publicly, obviously experiencing that condition, there will be different reactions. So with cancer, for example, people tend to have an oh dear, poor thing response. But with something like diabetes, it can be embarrassing for the young person who's maybe having to inject themselves or do a finger prick or something like that, or who wears a CGM. People will be familiar with those little white discs that a lot of people now wear to measure their blood glucose. That's another podcast as to whether or not that's appropriate. Okay. If you don't have a condition, should you be wearing one? But kids, so that's with diabetes particularly is something that can be stigmatizing, and people are scared of it if they don't understand it. So they make silly comments like, should you be eating that? Or oh, can you catch it? And so stigma is a thing that then can make the person with the condition feel bad about themselves. And if they feel bad about themselves, that can make it even harder to manage. And if you then think about another layer, which is adolescents who are obsessed with how they look and what they're wearing, if you add in that to people noticing them, they don't want to be noticed, but they do want to be noticed, but they're then getting noticed for the wrong reasons. So it's pretty hard. So if you've got all of these challenges of adolescence, and then you have the challenges that managing a chronic condition brings, they clash. And each one makes it hard to be successful at managing the other one.
Interesting. Sounds quite, yeah. Mm. It's hard enough having an adolescent versus them having something as well.
Yeah.
So maybe just to talk a little bit about parents' mindset in this case. Mm. So I had a friend and her daughter was actually at age 4 diagnosed with cancer. And they told the mother that to a big extent, her mindset will influence the child's outcome.
Mm.
So what can we say about the parents, either as a single parent or as a family unit? How does that influence the child, and does it?
So I think it's really important for people to be clear what is meant by outcome.
Okay.
So we're not talking about illness recovery or that kind of outcome. And I know there's a lot of stuff around if you have a very positive attitude, that'll improve your chances of survival and everything like that. But let's put that just to one side. Okay. So there are other outcomes in illness. We have to think about illness in a more holistic way. It's not just about the physical outcome. And we need parity of esteem for both physical and emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. So it is true that there's a lot of research. I always worry when I say it's true because true is not
research
a good word.
Changes as well.
It's not. I mean, true is not a good word.
Okay, but on average, let's say.
Is
that not good either?
Let's say that the research supports better quality of life and better psychological outcomes if parents are supported and parents have positive mental attitudes and good emotional well-being themselves.
Right.
Now, much harder for single parents, much, much harder for single parents because of all of the other confounding factors. And it's very easy in the media just to say, oh, single parents. Mm. But single parents have less income. They have less emotional support. They may not have such good living environment. There are so many other things that are confounding factors with being a single parent. And with carers where there's two, again, the challenges are financial because chronic illness can cause masses of financial demand. It can cause arguments as to how you manage and look after your child. Do you let them away with things because they're not well? And then there's the impact on siblings who feel ignored and can feel jealous and can themselves have an impact on their emotional well-being. So, yes, to some extent, there is some validity in saying if as a carer of a child, single or otherwise, you have a positive mental attitude, that will help your child have a more positive emotional outcome when they have a chronic illness. But it's not a guarantee.
Yeah.
So I think that's the other thing. You can be as positive as you like. Your child or adolescent can still be very, very unhappy. So I think it's a bit trite and a bit easy to just say, oh, you have to have a positive mental attitude. Because you have to think, well, what else do you have to have one? Have you got food?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you got an income? Yeah. Are you able to work? Are you able to pick your kids up from school? Are you able to make all of the hospital appointments? Yeah. And we forget all of this. So I think the other thing is it's so important that we don't just give support to the young people. Mm. We need to remember that they live in a system and that there are brothers and sisters.
I think that's interesting. The siblings,
parents,
which we tend to forget about.
They always get forgotten. And so got to remember those. And grandparents and school friends. No kid exists on their own in a little circle. They've got a whole system around them. And that system needs to be encouraged and supported to support the young person.
Do they get that? Is that easy to come by?
It's a bit of a postcode lottery, really. I mean, the child and adolescent mental health services are completely overrun with severe mental health concerns and problems. The hospitals themselves now do have more pediatric psychological services, but they're often overrun and have waiting lists. They might just see the child and not provide support to the family. So like many things at the moment, it's a bit of a postcode lottery.
Right, okay. Another thing that we read about in the press often, and I think it's getting more and more popular, is ADHD.
Mm.
So just walk us quickly through what that is and how does ADHD and adolescence kind of clash together?
Mm. So ADHD is chronically underdiagnosed. It's really important to say that. It's also important to be very, very clear that ADHD is a biological neurodevelopmental condition. It's not something that's caused by what you eat. It's not something that's caused by chaotic parenting. Mm. It is a biological neurodevelopmental condition where the brain does not develop in a neurotypical way. And what you end up with are three core symptoms. So inattention, impulsivity and often hyperactivity. Now, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is a really rubbish name because people with ADHD don't have a deficit of attention.
They have too much.
They don't. Well, yeah, kind of. It's they have struggled to focus.
Yeah.
And it's because their prefrontal cortex is not completely wired up the way a neurotypical cortex is fired up. So they have difficulty with key executive functions. So they will have difficulty with metacognition, thinking about thinking. They will have difficulty with working memory, that short-term processing capacity that we need to kind of keep on track. They will have difficulty self-monitoring. They will have difficulty being flexible and managing change. And they will also be often incredibly impulsive. So, that's ADHD. And what's adolescence? Adolescence is all of that.
More of the same.
More of the same. So it's often a bit like ADHD on top of adolescence makes it much harder to get through adolescence. And of course it makes it hard. And there's also social challenges for young people with ADHD for lots of different reasons. Yeah. But that then can interfere with a young person's ability to make friends. And again, what's important for an adolescent? Making friends. And if you've got ADHD, that can be a challenge. So it's really important that neurodiversity is recognised. It's really important that there's more education, both for teachers and schools and parents and for the young people themselves, so that they understand that the things that they struggle with, first of all, are manageable, and it can be, you can be trained, you can be coached, so that you can and you can also use things like mindfulness to improve the connectivity. So there's some good research that shows regular mindfulness behaviors and mindfulness activities can actually help develop those frontal cortex connections. So it's not that you can never do it.
Yeah.
Although that's somehow it fits, sometimes that's how it feels. But it's not that with ADHD you can never do these things. It's just that it is more difficult for you. But if you can get the right support and reasonable adjustments in your schooling and in your workplace and in your family, then you can do what everybody else does.
Okay. I think sometimes it's enough that we're aware of it, right?
So. Well, self-awareness.
Yeah.
So important. Yeah. Understanding why you might be impulsive or understanding why you might not be great at managing time, or understanding that you get very hyper-focused and work and forget to go to the loo and forget to have tea. I mean, that's self-care.
Yeah.
And so you might just need somebody to say, right, because you've got ADHD, it's very hard for you to remember to do these things. I'm going to come knock on the door. Okay. And say, do you need a cup of tea and do you need to go to the loo? There's some various, there are ways of working around it. But again, we don't have anywhere near enough support. And getting an ADHD diagnosis, for example, is awful at the moment. It can take years. It can for adults, it can take up to 4 years on the NHS. And for children, it can take 1 year, 2 years, 3 years.
Right.
Again, depends where you live. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So you're a clinical psychologist.
I am, yes.
And also a grandmother. Which is sweet.
Very proud grandma.
Oh. So you have an interesting grandson that you're going to tell us something about.
Yes.
And also what I'm interested in are the two roles. What's the word? Can you put the two roles together or do you have to keep them separate?
Okay. So, yes, I have five beautiful grandchildren.
Okay. Congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely love them all. Very proud of them, ranging in age from 2.5 up to 19 in 1 month's time.
Okay.
They're all fabulous, fun. And I love spending time with all of them. But just over a year ago, my grandson, who is 13, was diagnosed with diabetes.
Okay.
And of course, it felt like a really bad joke of the universe given that I had spent 25 years working in diabetes, writing a book about how to manage teenagers with diabetes, to now have a teenager with diabetes. It was not funny. It was really hard. I was very, very upset. And I experienced all of the emotional distress that I had supported people with for years. I had worked with people who had just been told that their son or daughter or grandson or daughter had been diagnosed, and I would be the psychologist in the room supporting them and helping them think through that distress. I was lucky. I had lots of friends, and some of whom are psychologists. But I told them to stop being a psychologist and just be a friend. So I experienced that. And there's a big difference between living it emotionally and knowing it in your heart and knowing it intellectually. And your question, can you be both? Nope. Absolutely not. Wow. I mean, I found that when I had my boy, when my boys were teenagers and I would do my psyche stuff with them, they would look at me and go, would you stop it?
Oh, no way.
So they sussed you out. So I used to do all this really cool stuff, you know, people with headaches, I would help them manage their migraines. And if one of them had, I'd say, okay, so we're just, and they'd go, go away. Just go away. And with, so I learned. But with Xander, my grandson, I've had to really be careful because I'm so aware. I've written papers about being a teenager and how to be with a teenager. And so I just have to try and follow my advice and not give it. So maybe that's the big difference. Okay. And of course, I said to him when he was diagnosed, oh, you need, would you like to speak to a psychologist? And he looked at me and said, seriously, Grandma, what are they going to take it away from me? And I said, well, no, that's a good point. No, I wasn't suggesting that a psychologist was going to make your diabetes better. I said, but, you know, they could help you think about what it's like to have diabetes. And he said, I'll think about it. And he's basically done that every time I've said, do you want to see somebody? And he goes, I'll think about it, Graham. That's his way of telling me to buzz off. Okay. So he is doing really well. I'm very, very proud of him. He hasn't stopped doing anything. He eats chocolate Easter eggs. He climbs Snowdon. He does judo. Okay. He's doing his Duke of Edinburgh Award. He hasn't let diabetes stop him, but it does make him miserable at times. And he hates it with a vengeance. Mm. And we have had that conversation. He will become even better at managing it. And he is pretty good at managing it right now. But in answer, no, you can't be a psychologist to your grandson. You just have to let other people do that. Yeah. And you have to just bite your lip.
And just be a grandma.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So saying that, you now run your own business. Mm-hmm. You are a transformational coach. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've kind of combined all my experience as a psychologist, mm-hmm. working with adolescents and working with parents, working with people with neurodiversity, with a coaching practitioner level qualification in coaching, which I've been doing for about 3 years. And so I kind of call it thoaching.
Thoaching.
It's a bit of a mix of therapy and coaching. Yeah, okay. It means that, so I work in a very solution-focused and motivational interview-based way. So very positive, a sort of positive psychology approach. Mm-hmm. And it's about inviting people to find their own answers. And I work with people within the NHS, within the public sector, as well as individuals with ADHD. So I do individual coaching and also group coaching. And I love it. It's really, really nice. Work with some emerging adults as well.
Good word.
Yeah, so I do some work with emerging adults and with parents, helping them think about how to manage their adolescence.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. Very cool. So I love doing that. It's great fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad you found like a nice purpose as well. So to end this topic of adolescence and psychology, would you have a positive takeaway for our viewers and listeners today?
I think I would definitely say that adolescence can be one of the most exciting and fulfilling times, and they can offer you so much because they're growing and you can see them growing. And if you can just be patient, there is light at the end of the tunnel. I think the other expression, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
And remember that even if they are driving you mad, you're going to want to be their best friend when they're in their early 20s. And if you can just let them know that. And I think being really honest with them and saying, you know what, you're driving me insane, but I'm really looking forward to when you're a grown up. And then you get so many dividends. So like I said, two fabulous adults, big bearded men, and five fabulous grandchildren. And we're, you know, very, very lucky that they want to spend time with us.
Yeah.
So I think we must have done some things okay. But I also want to say to the parents, don't try and be perfect.
Okay.
You can't be perfect. You can only be good enough. You can only try your best. And if you do that and don't beat yourself up and are patient and compassionate with yourself, as being patient and compassionate with your adolescents, there's a great dividend when they grow up.
That was lovely, Deborah. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you. I really love talking with you. Really enjoyed it, Coco.
Thanks, Deborah. Bye.